This is The Biz of Wealth. Challenges, rumblings, and evolution of the wealth management industry.
Welcome to The Business of Wealth. Today, I sat down with Ari Abraham, whose business is to help high net worth individuals, real estate investors, business owners, and retirees grow and protect their wealth predictably and safely. He's a financial consultant and has cultivated a reputation for putting his client first no matter what. He prides himself on attending all client meetings without expectations or preconceived ideas to ensure that he is solving his client's problems. Today, we spoke about the challenges of being a financial advisor and the future of his role. So, Sari, welcome to The Business of Wealth. Thank you so much for being here. It's a pleasure.
Hi, Alejandro. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
So we're going to go right into, you know, getting to know a little bit each other. And I wanted to first ask, I'd like to see it from parents' perspective always. So I always ask, how would your parents describe what you do for a living?
How would they describe what I do for a living?
Yes.
They helps people financially with their money, helps manage their money. That's how they would describe me.
Okay, good. And what's the best compliment you've ever received?
The best compliment I've ever received is that I'm very passionate. I like when people say that.
Good. Yes, it's always good, especially in entrepreneurship, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think entrepreneurship, like, you have to be passionate. You have to do it out of like your DNA, like out of your heart, and to make up who you actually are, more than just the money. But I think with entrepreneurship, you definitely have to be very passionate.
How did you end up as a financial advisor? Why even finance?
Yeah, so I've always had like a passion for problem solving, as well as for money, the idea of money and how it being important. Not so much of like how from it being cool, but also from it in helping people and how it's usually a root for a lot of problems. So I've always been intrigued by that, and I kind of always wanted to figure out how to solve that problem. I think that if I, you know, I realized that when I was doing my MBA, that if I could solve financial problems, then I could pretty much do anything, you know. I could help people in a lot of different ways, but at the same time, it was a very vague goal. I didn't know exactly what I was going to do. That's why I got my MBA. I was kind of just going throughout my MBA program, just kind of like blindly going through it almost, where I was just looking for the next step. I got into insurance and financial services, and that helped me a lot. That helped me a lot think about how people looked at money and how they also looked at their assets and how they viewed it, and how it was the tool they were using, right? And then that led to Medicare. I was a Medicare consultant for a few years where I was helping people who were like over the age of 65. And they would ask me like financial questions too, because I was working with them and helping them like budget for their for their Medicare plan and other health insurance. And then I read a book, actually. The book is called The Bank on Yourself Revolution by Pamela Yellen. And it talks about the strategy, the bank on yourself strategy, and how there's a lot of, with conventional finance, there's a lot of problems with how like 401ks are, IRAs, the stock market, and different things like that. So again, back to the problem solving, I was like, you know, this is a problem for a lot of people. And if I could understand this concept and understand the subject, there's a lot that I could do to help. So I ended up going through the Bank on Yourself training. I became a Bank on Yourself professional. And then I started the company Financial Asset Protection. So we are a financial services firm, and we help clients in all 50 states manage their finances. We have a lot of real estate investors, real estate brokers, entrepreneurs. And yeah, it's been wonderful. It's been great. And then I have a show called Thinking Like a Bank too, where we talk about these strategies and principles. You know, so it's been wonderful so far.
So you've been some years in the industry, and you know it's going through a transformation, mm-hmm. you know, from the traditional business model of wealth management. What do you yep. think, what works, what needs to change? Where do you see it going?
Yeah, so one thing I see happening right now is I see it. So like, for example, like 6 years ago, you know, that might seem like a short period of time, but technology wise, that was a long time ago, right? 6 years ago in the technological world, like 6 years ago is like 50 years ago, almost, based on what's happened over the last 6 years. And I remember that I would, you know, when I would talk to like financial advisors and brokers, and I would say like, what if you have a client, you know, you're in Chicago and you have a client in California, Would you be able to do business with them? And they would say, like, technically you could, but that probably won't happen. The client won't trust you. They won't understand you. It's better to do everything face to face. So just only do business locally. That was the way that I had seen financial services six years ago. However, fast forward to today, especially after COVID, that's completely different. Now it's very normal to do business with somebody across the world over Zoom or over the phone. It was still present 6 years ago, but it wasn't as common as it is today. So I think one major trend for financial services is going to be in telecom and Zoom sales over Zoom virtually. That is definitely going to be increasing over time. And I think that's a good thing. Not only does it make it more versatile and more adaptive to the industry, it also, like, let's say, for example, you do live in California and there's, you know, an advisor in Chicago that you want to work with. You don't have to stay locally. You can go to that specific advisor. You could choose. You could find more talent and more people who are in line with your goals when you go nationally and you have really no geographic limits. So that's where I see it going.
So basically you say that the transformation is regarding the markets that you can work with. Mm-hmm. What about the products you're offering and the fee-based versus, well, the fiduciary responsibility, the open platforms? Where do you see that going?
Yeah, definitely. I see that, you know, it's a little bit tricky because that's still going to have, like, due to the licensing, like, for example, an agent who does, or an advisor who does fee only, won't be able to do, like, insurance products, and usually vice versa. Insurance products probably won't be able to do fee-based products. So I think that's still going to have the fine line. I think one change is going to be in client awareness. Like, clients are going to be more aware because of all the podcasts and all the YouTube videos out there and the free content out there, that clients now are more informed. They have an idea now what to do. Because here's the thing, like, I think, you know, like, when you, if you had a financial question and then you go to, you know, for example, somebody near you who is a financial advisor, that's what their title is. And then you sit with them, they might be a fee only advisor, meaning that the only things that can really help you with are looking at your portfolio and stocks, bonds, mutual funds. And that might not be a good fit for you, but because you understand this is what financial advisors do, I'm speaking in the past, of course, you may be more open to go with them. But nowadays, because of all the content out there, it's all the material, all the information people have access to, they now have, like, more choices and then more understanding of what to do. So that is another difference, I think, is that people are going to be more familiar with the differences between, like, the terms you're using, like fee only versus an advisor who works on commission and other areas of financial services.
So what you're saying is that we have a more informed investor, a more informed user. Do you think they're going to go with the do-it-yourself kind of services, or, you know, of course, the robo-advisors of the world, mm-hmm. the robo-inputs of the world? What do you see the role of the advisor being there? Because there is a clear trend that, you know, a lot of investors are going that route.
Yeah, and that's a good question. That's a good observation, because you're right. A lot of, not just in financial services, but a lot of different industries, that do-it-yourself model is starting to grow. Like, for example, like, look at taxes. You know, like, you have all these apps nowadays that it's almost like free or very cheap to use, where you could just on your phone do your taxes. The problem with that is I think that it only helps a small number of the population. Because think about it this way. Let's say in terms of taxes, let's say that you are in college still, you're single, and you have one part-time job. Yeah, that's something you could probably do over the app. You would just literally plug in what was your income and then other information. And let's say you would just push submit, and then your taxes are done. But now let's say you're like 50 years old, you have kids, you're married, you own a house, you have a real estate property, you own a business, your wife's a full-time employee. Like, you have all these different, like, moving parts now. Now you probably need a certified public accountant. And I think the same is true with financial services. It's like, if you want to buy stocks, or you want to buy some bonds, or you want to do some, like, light investing, yeah, you could do so now for much less than you could in the past. Just through, like, Robinhood and through these apps, it's much easier now to do it. You could do it on yourself. But for those who have the more complex situations, I definitely think that you always need an actual human to work with, somebody who understands, like, financial planning, and somebody who can coordinate with your accountant and lawyer, not just somebody who can give you legal advice or accounting advice or you know, but somebody who could coordinate with them and work with them, I think that will never go away. Like, you always need the person helping you, because people have tricky situations, especially people who, you know, entrepreneurs, real estate investors, you know, maybe they also have full-time jobs, things like that, make it a little bit more, make the solution a little bit more complex.
Well, yeah, it goes in line with what you know, the famous story of Betterman. Betterman launched as a robo advisor, and then they decided to add advisors into their offering, right? And basically pay to be part of that service. Definitely the human touch is needed there. But yep. Are you saying then that financial advisors are continued to be reserved for the more complex or ultra high net worth or high net worth individuals only?
That, yeah, definitely, for sure. The high net worth individuals and ultra high net worth individuals will always need like people to work with, actual financial advisors to work with. And I also see one other trend is more on the financial coaching side. This is where, for example, like you might not be wealthy right now. You might have debt or are struggling as an entrepreneur, and then having a financial coach, somebody who works with you to help you solve your financial problems. I see that as a growing trend too. So somebody that you could work with. And again, you don't have to be already wealthy and have a lot of money to work with a financial coach. And this is something we help our clients with too. Like we work with clients at all stages, at all levels in their life, whether they're brand new entrepreneurs or, you know, experienced high net worth individuals, we work with them. But I think that's a growing trend too, is that working with like more on the coaching side. And what I mean by coaching is that you're working with somebody regardless of their financial situation. So whether they're in debt or whether they have a lot of money, you're working with them and you're helping them achieve their goals.
I like that. But how do you manage revenue streams there? You know, how do you make it profitable from a coach standpoint? I've worked with firms that we help them launch that model, actually, you know, the financial coaching model, but still tricky in terms of the traditional wealth management mind says, no, I need them to have some AUM so that I can, you know, cover my bases. So on one hand, you're betting on the growth, the future growth of that client. But on the other hand, are you being profitable or just waiting?
Yeah, so it could be both. Yeah, it could be like long term where you're working with clients and then hopefully you'll get referrals from them. Hopefully their business will launch and they're going to come to you. So that's one angle of it. And the other angle of it too is to charge for financial coaching hours. That's not that difficult to do. And it's probably not going to cost the client that much money. You could probably do something where it's like, I don't know, $100, $150 an hour to start with. And they buy like 1 hour a week or something like that. So that way they're paying like $400 or $500 a month. For financial coaching, that could give them a huge impact. And I get what you're saying. A lot of advisors are going to say, you know, they would rather make like, you know, $10,000 a year off each client than $500 a month off of, you know, one client, you know, so there is that profitability calculation in that. But yeah, there's two ways that you can make that profitable. One way is through, like, for example, I work with anybody. But then hopefully when they do become successful or from referrals or from even like smaller cases too. So they can still do, even though they don't have that much money, they can still do smaller cases. That's one way. And the other way is through charging for hourly rates for financial coaching.
So basically that's the way you work. Do you actually, you know, propose to your clients, hey, let's do financial coaching because you're not ready for the investment side of things yet?
Yeah, exactly. So I am, my only compensation is through commission. So I typically, through the bank on yourself concept, I work with three insurance companies, and my only form of compensation is after a case gets closed through one of the three insurance companies we work with. That's the only way I get paid. So what that means is, so clients could work with me for free, essentially until it's time to fund a solution. This is typically how the process would work. Somebody would reach out, they would hear me on a podcast, or they would hear on our podcast or something like that. They'd reach out for like a 15-minute intro call. And then we would see if we're a good fit, if we connect. And then after that, it would go to a financial analysis meeting. The financial analysis meeting is about 1 hour long. And this is where we get to know their financial situation and their goals and their objectives, like where they want to go in the next 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. That's obviously all free. And then the third meeting is we do something called a personalized solution meeting. This is where we present the solution to the client, showing them, you know, using one or maybe more than one insurance company that we have and different products that they each have. how it could help them with their financial situation. And again, this is relevant to the bank on yourself solution or the bank on yourself strategy. So we're going to show them how that strategy could help them, assuming it could. And then the fourth step is we would submit the application to the insurance company, and then no funds would be needed yet. So we would submit the applications to the insurance company. About 4 to 6 weeks later, the insurance company would come back and say, all right, we've approved it, or we've declined the application, or they have some questions or other things like that. Assuming they do approve it, then the client has like 2 months after that to start funding the solution. So that's how our company operates.
So playing devil's advocate here, if I'm your client, how am I sure that you are giving me the product that I need and not just the one that is going to end up being in your commission?
And that's a good question. Yeah. So one thing that we do is on the financial analysis, we're asking questions that are only about the client and only about their financial situation. So it's like they're open-ended questions. And this is something that, like, for example, if you're not going to work with us, like if you want just like advice on working with other agents out there, like make sure they ask you questions that are open-ended and not steered to their favor. So it's like, for example, one question that would be, steering towards somebody's favor is, do you want to invest in the stock market? Obviously, you're going to want to, it's probably going to end up in yes or something like that. But we only ask like open-ended questions to get to know their financial situation. And it's like the example of, imagine you go to the doctor's office and the doctor, as soon as you walk in, just has a prescription ready for you. You know, you're going to be like, I didn't even tell you what was wrong. But if you that's why the doctors have to ask questions, what's wrong. And then after you tell them what's wrong, then they come up with a diagnosis and then a prescription or recommendation. And the same is true with a financial planner. A financial planner should ask you, what is it that you want to accomplish? What are your goals? And then make the recommendation that will fit your goals.
So what is the most common problem that come to, for your financial assessment, what's the most common problem you always answer about?
The most common problem I've seen so far, people not being able to save. So I work with a lot of people who make a lot of money and just don't save, because they probably, I don't know exactly why they don't save. They just spend a lot of money. So part of the bank on yourself strategy is it gives you the opportunity to save more money, because you're almost like creating obstacles around your money, but still making your money accessible. And I think that's a smart thing to do from a financial, standpoint. I think you want your money to live somewhere and to work for you, but also it's accessible, but not too accessible. Like if you think about, for example, your checking account and then you have a debit card or credit card, your money is, the reason why people spend so much money is because their money is so accessible. It's so easy to access, either from plastic in their hands or, from an app, Apple Pay and other things like that from their phone, they could just buy things easily. So there's no really red tape around your money. And to build financial security for the future, you do need to create some sort of obstacles or boundaries around your money to make it just a little bit harder. Not like you have to wait 10 years to access it. I think that's too much. But I think like every time you want to access your money, you have to wait like 3 or 5 business days. I think that perception of that and creating some of the obstacles around it will make a huge difference in your life when it comes to saving.
That reminds me of like putting obstacles in your fridge. I remember when people are on a diet, you want to put a sign on your fridge. Hey, remember your diet. It's like building habits, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think what I've seen is like the most successful people are really good at this stuff. They have all these like boundaries and red tapes in their life. So that way, because they know that they're going to fall into a trap. They know that, self-discipline can only go so far, so you need these tools and methods in place to create obstacles for yourself.
Yeah. It's also building delayed gratification. That's psychological term that everybody uses, but it's hard in the financial world. Well, it is statistically correct what you're saying, like that the rate of saving in the US is very, very poor. And that's something that it's built into, I think it's also the system, right? From when you're young and you're offered all these credit cards and all these things, constantly, looking for things to buy, thinking about the future. Okay, and so what do you think in the industry, you know, what's missing? What should, you know, wealth management firms be doing right now that they're not doing?
Yeah, I think so. My mentor told me the same. He's like, you can either choose to do something based off of, you could find a method first and then that'll fit your objective, or you could find an objective first and then find the method for the objective. In other words, people usually take two steps. They either go with objective first or method first. And I think it's always important to start with your objective first and then find the method that will fit your objective. Because if you do the opposite, if you choose method first, then you're probably choosing somebody else's objective. And this is where, to answer your question, what could be improved in the financial and the wealth management space is that I think the advisors need to focus more on the client's overall objectives and not to just assume a method. Because if I, for example, create an app right now where you can invest in the stock market and it'll help you invest in the stock market, I'm assuming that that's what you want to do. I'm assuming that you want to put your money in the stock market. So that's one huge issue right there, is that the objectives are already assumed. And rather, it should be the opposite. It should be, what is it that you want to accomplish? What is it that you truly want to accomplish? And then kind of really focus on that person and then where they want to see their life going, and then find the solution that will fit that, and have like and be agile enough so that way you're not worried that if a client chooses something other than what you could do, it's going to harm your business or harm your profitability. Because like if I, for example, I'm a financial advisor and I only do AUM, you know, I only do stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and a client is talking to me about, you know, he or she wants to do real estate. This happens a lot, by the way. The financial advisor now has to either turn the client down or convince the client that the second scenario is probably going to be more realistic, convince the client not to do real estate and to do like stocks, bonds, mutual funds. And I'm not saying that financial advisors are bad. I'm saying that this is the way of the business. It's like you have to like, you know, they're not going to make money if the client goes through real estate, especially if they go through like traditional real estate where they're investing in like in syndication or other properties. The advisor can't really make money off that. Maybe if it goes through like a real estate trust, they probably could, but for the most part, they're going to move them more towards stocks, bonds, and mutual funds.
So basically, you're advising on more independence.
More independence and more around the client's overall objectives, and not just shiny.
So I'm a financial advisor. I have a product offering that is, you know, insurance or stocks. How do I make sure I have a healthy flow of clients to make sure that I'm really only getting those that fit the products that I need? I'm gonna ask you one question that a lot of people have a hard time with, but let's see what you think. Tell me something that's true that almost nobody agrees with you on.
Something that's true that nobody agrees with me on. This is a tough one. Yeah, this is a tough one. Let me think. Just one second, please. Let me just think. I got one. So let me ask you a question. If you had $100,000 in the stock market and you lost 10%, how much would you have to gain percentage-wise to go back to where you were?
Is it like double?
It's like if you lost 10%, you would need 11% to go back to where you were. And then it keeps increasing.
Like 20. Wait, no, you're right.
So a lot of people think that this is where a lot of people disagree, even though it's basic math. A lot of people think that if you have like money in the stock market and you lost 10%, you only need 10% to go back to where you were. If you lost 20% and then you gained 20%, you're back to where you were. And that's not true. You know, mathematically, you can do the math on it. It actually, the larger the loss, the greater you need the return to be just to break even. So if you lost, if you had $100,000, you lost 50% of that, it drops down to 50%. You need like 100% just to go back to where you were.
You need a return that's double the dip.
Double, yeah, just to go back to where you were. Yeah. So that's something that, you know, this is back to like this, you know, stock market not being a good fit for a lot of people, is that you need to consider losses. And then consider too, is that like, if you had, for example, year one, you had, you know, 100,000, and then the stock market went up or down over the last 10 years, and then now you're at 110,000, somebody might say, well, your rate of return was 10%. You started with 100,000, now you have 110,000. And that's not true, because you have to divide that over 10 years and then subtract fees and then subtract taxes. And then now, let's just say it was the same number, it was 100,000. You broke even. You also lost money because of inflation and because of the loss of opportunity cost you could have earned had that money been invested somewhere else. So that's something that, you know, people don't really believe me on.
Okay. And last one, as an entrepreneur, it's important to, you know, to know yourself. What do you think you're not very good at?
Not very good at, so one thing I have to do right now is to create content, and I have to do like solo YouTube videos. And I'm not good at that at all. Like, I could talk on podcasts. I have no problem with that, but to look at a camera and just talk alone for like a YouTube video,
it's some people, like, you know, you see those people on Instagram that keep talking to the camera. I'm like, how do they do it? It's like speaking on the, you know, on WhatsApp. A lot of friends I have, they send like all these long messages in audio. And I'm like, how do you speak by yourself for so long?
Right. You're so right.
I don't get it. I'm like, I cannot speak without a feedback. I'm like, I can't preach by myself.
Exactly. I'm the same way. Exactly.
No, but that, you know, that's one thing that I always work with my clients. It's like, you have to find the format that best works for you. Mm-hmm. Don't go into whatever the trend is. Go into what you can accomplish, because we have so much and so little time. You need to focus on what you can do and what you know you're going to do. So I completely.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, it was great meeting you. Thank you so much for your time and feedback.
Alejandra, thanks so much for having me on.
We'll see you soon.